I'm pulling out of the driveway. We all know what that means. It's time to drive to work. Okay, recently I did a podcast all about Stronghold. So today is about Exodus. This is in my quest to have a podcast about every Magic expansion ever. I'm moving my way. I've been going through all the ones I haven't done yet. But anyway, I did Tempest. My very first podcast ever was Tempest. But it's taken me a while to do Stronghold and Exodus. So I did Stronghold. Today I'm doing Exodus. So Exodus is a small set. 143 cards, 55 commons, 44 uncommons, 44 rares. It's the third set in the Tempest block. The design was led by Mike Elliott. The design team was Mike, Bill Rose, and myself. And then the development team, led by William Jockish, was the five Magic R&D people at the time. William, Mike, Bill, Henry Stern, and me. This is back when Magic design was small enough that there were five of us, and we were every development team. If you remember from Exodus, the Tempest story basically boiled down to Sisse, the captain of the Weatherlight, has been kidnapped, along with Takara, who's the daughter of Stark, because he was showing them how to get there, how to get to Wrath. Anyway, they have to go rescue him. So in Tempest, they arrive in Wrath, which is an artificial plane created by we don't know who. They get attacked by the Predator, which is another flying ship run by Grevin Ilvek, who's the right-hand man of Volrath, Volrath being the main bad guy. During that, Gerard gets knocked overboard, apparently killed, but he's actually not killed. He is saved. And then they end up taking all of the legacy, including Karn, who's part of a legacy. Tom Garth jumps aboard the Predator ship, ends up getting captured. So now they have to rescue Sisse and Takara and Karn and Tom Garth. A lot of people to rescue. So they travel there. They meet the elves. Eladamri is the head of the elves. There's a master plan where they will break into the stronghold and then open up the gate to allow the attacking army of elves to attack. That's the master plan. The end of the Tempest story is they have to go through the death pits and the of Wrath and the furnace of Wrath and fight the slivers. And anyway, they end up getting to the stronghold. So the second set stronghold is at Volro's stronghold, and they break in. One of the big events is they meet the angel Selenia, which is a long story, but, she's trying to kill, Krovax. Miri jumps in the way, gets injured instead of Krovax, and Krovax has to kill Selenia. That finishes his curse, and he has turned into a vampire. When we built the Weatherlight crew, we wanted to have all the different colors represented. We wanted to have the color black represented, and we thought it'd be cool to have a vampire on the ship, but we're like, well, they just let a vampire on the ship. So the idea was he didn't start as a vampire, but he became a vampire with the plan. Obviously, the current crew has a vampire on the ship, but anyway. So what happened was they basically free the people they need to free. And there's a sweet scene between Khan and the Sliver Queen. They're trying to escape. So the story of Exodus, it's the Exodus, it's the leaving. So basically what happened is when the ship gets attacked by the Predator, the device that lets them travel through the planes gets injured. So they don't have a means to escape from Wrath. But there's a gate, a planar gate, that they can use. And it is being, there's a Sultari emissary named Lina who's overseeing it. They drop off Urtai, and Urtai is supposed to convince Lina to open up the gate. So that is going on while they're in the stronghold. Urtai is not with them in the stronghold. So anyway, they manage to get back to the ship. So the ending of Stronghold is they get back to their ship, and they're about to leave when a series of events happens that gets us into Exodus. Basically, Grevin Ilvek shows up. Gerard and Grevin Ilvek get into a fight. Also, Miri, Krovax leaves the ship. Miri follows Krovax, although she's injured, but she is curious. It's on Curiosity. there ends up being a fight between Miri and Krobak. So Krobak is trying to kill Miri. Also, Ertai has communicated with Lena, the Sotari emissary. And what he says is, hey, guys, I got the gate open, but she can only have it open for so long. You need to hurry. Otherwise, we're going to miss our opportunity to get out of Wrath. Oh, the other thing that happened in Stronghold is they learned the plans that this is actually an invasion plan by the Phyrexians. And that there's a larger, they understand the larger thing at play, that the Phyrexians want to invade Dominaria. Okay, so from behind the scenes, I'm starting with the story. We'll get to the mechanics in a sec. The reason I'm starting with the story is, to me, the major behind-the-scenes story of Exodus has to do with the story. So Michael Ryan and I, as I explained during our Tempest and Stronghold podcast, we had pitched the idea of an ongoing story, the Weatherlight Saga. We pitched it to Rick Ahrens, who's the head of the Magic Brand Manager at the time. He was very excited. I'm so excited that he wanted to start right away. So the preamble was actually done in Weatherlight, and then the story starts in earnest in Tempest. So Michael and I were the representatives. I was still in R&D, but I was like the representative. And then Michael was brought over to the creative team. And then we created a whole new creative team full of all sorts of people to do our first real world building. Wrath was built by a group of artists that did actual internal world building. Magic now does it all the time. This was sort of the beginning of us actually, like, if you go back to really early Magic, they would just ask the artist to draw things, but there was no necessary cohesiveness to it, that how one person looked versus another. Nowadays, we build worlds, and, like, this is what the world looks like, and these are the different people, and this is what the different characters of the world look like, and what the different species of the world look like, and here's the clothing and the weapons, and there's a lot done to really unify things so it feels like one cohesive world. Early Magic was a little less cohesive. Each individual artist was sort of drawing their own thing, and we'd have connective tissue, like, oh, it's sort of Nordic, or it has an African feel, or whatever, but it wasn't like we do now, where we really have world building. And the first real world we built was Wrath. So what happens is, Michael and I are in charge of the story, and they make a creative team. They bring a creative team to do all this big lifting and design the character looks and do the world building and all the stuff that you guys take for granted now as part of what the creative team does, but at the time wasn't something they necessarily did. So there was, I'm not going to get into names or anything. I will suffice to say there was some tension between an individual on the creative team and Michael and myself. And that person did not agree with a lot of choices that Michael and I were making about the story. So as I explained last time, we were using Joseph Campbell as our structure. We were doing the hero, the myth of the epic hero, I believe is the story. Joseph Campbell, for those who don't know, believes that there are certain stories that humans keep telling because they're to the core of our experience, one of which is the myth of the epic hero. Star Wars is the myth of the epic hero. Moses. There's a lot of stories where the idea is a character who doesn't know sort of how special they are, who just seem to be living a mundane life, turns out to be really important in ways they didn't realize, and they have to, you know, step up. And anyway, there's a whole, Michael and I very much followed the mold of that, and we were very careful. We wanted all the crew, for example, we put together the Weatherlight crew. We wanted to embody all the different aspects of magic. We wanted to hit the different colors of magic. We wanted to hit a lot of different iconic elements of magic. So we spent a lot of time sort of crafting it and building our story. This particular person did not share our vision. For example, they didn't like Cat Warriors, for example. There were some things that we did that they just disagreed with. And as time went on, the tension grew. And it finally got to a point where it was clear that Michael and I, or this other person, we couldn't coexist. It was getting too hard. And so we went to the brand manager, which was Rick, and said, okay, look, this is one of these two things has to go. And Rick chose, not Michael and I, chose the other person to stay. So Michael and I left the story. So Exodus is the point at which we left. So basically what was supposed to happen is, in our version of the story, Miri is injured and Krobak turns into a vampire, but they they don't fight to the death. That isn't something that was in our version. Miri being injured ends up being a big part of our version of the Mercati story. The storyline did end up going to Mercati and going back to Dominaria, but once you get beyond Wrath, it really, really starts deviating from our story. There's little tiny components, but mostly the Tempest Block story is mostly our story, and then the rest of the story really isn't our story. For example, while we did tie into the old story by having Hannah be the son of Baron and Urtai from Solarian Academy, like, we did a little bit of tying into the old story, but Urza was not part of our story. That was added later. The idea that this was all master plan of Urza, that was not Michael and my doing. So anyway, in our version of the story, Miri is not injured. I'm sorry, Miri's injured, but Miri does not die because she died. In the version of the Exodus, what happens is Krogax ends up killing Miri. And we made a big pitch at the time. We're like, look, if you're going to have Krogax fight Miri, at least let Gerard save Miri, right? Because the setting, like I said, the story is Gerard is fighting Brevin, Miri is fighting Krogax, and Urtai is saying, hey, if we don't leave, we're in trouble. So what we said is, look, if you really have to have Krogax fighting Miri, which is not what we wanted, but at least Gerard has to, like, look, stop fighting Brevin. Yeah, it'll come back to haunt you, whatever, fine, it's a good story. Go save your best friend, you know, and then, you'll be delayed getting to the gate, but that means, so, and what happens in the story, which was part of our story, is they end up using what's called the Wind Shaper, which is this legacy artifact that produces wind, and it gets them to the gate on time, just before it closes, but in our version of the story, they crash land on the other side, that they're going too fast, and yes, they manage to escape. Now, in our version, they do strand Urtai behind, as they do in the actual story. I did a whole podcast on the alternate version of the story. Basically, our version involved them going to Mercadia. When they get back to Dominaria, there's a time jump. Urtai shows up as an old man. That's our version of the story. But anyway, in our version, Miri stays on the ship, but injured. Krovac stays on the ship, but now vampire, and they have to deal with that. Like, we were trying to, we wanted all the different colors of magic, but in the story that we, not our version, Miri gets killed. The one green character on the Weatherlight crew killed. Krovac is the one black character. He ends up he leaves. Urtai gets stranded. So we have nothing but red and white characters left on the ship. So Gerard is white, Orym is white, Hannah is like maybe white and blue. And we have Tongarth is red, Sissy is white, Squee is red. So you have a lot of white and red. I guess a little tiny bit of blue in Hannah. But no black, no green. So anyway, the way the story plays out there, Krovac kills Miri. Miri dies. Krovac leaves and goes off and sort of becomes evil. In our version, he didn't. I mean, he was a vampire, but he wasn't evil. So anyway, Michael and I sort of leave in the middle of this. That there's a behind the scenes to me. That's my big memory of Exodus is it's really the breakup where Michael and I stopped doing the story. Anyway, I've now talked about that for probably more than I need to. Let's move on to the making of the set. Okay, so Exodus is the third set in the block, and what that means is back in the day, back in the early blocks, we would have two named mechanics. In Mirage, it was flanking and phasing. In Urza Saga, it was Echo and Cycling. So our two were Buyback and Shadow. So Buyback, we had done in the first set. In the first set in Tempest, it's only generic mana costs. Then in Stronghold, we try colored mana costs and one card that doesn't have mana costs. And then really, it's in this set, in Exodus, that we start exploring other costs other than mana. We have paying life. We have discarding cards. We have sacking lands. The idea that there's ways and things you can buy back that just don't cost mana, cost some other resource. There are 6 new shadow cards. There were, I think, 12 in the original Tempest, 3 in Stronghold, and 6 more. They definitely do some things that help. Like, one of them is, like, equal to the size of your shadow creatures and stuff. So just more things to kind of build your shadow deck. Some card-by-card innovation, but nothing, no larger-scale innovation like with Buyback. There are no new Slivers, but there are 2 new Lissids. And then the new things in the set is we have some more spikes that we introduced. There's one spike in Tempest, and then we did a bunch of them in Stronghold. There's a few more in the set. The two things we did that were brand new is we did two cycles, the Oath cycle and the Keeper cycle. So Oath of Lieges in white. So the way it worked was the oaths were, if you were down on some resource, you got access to that resource. Oath of Lieges was if you were down on lands. Oath of Scholars if you were down on cards in hand. Oath of Ghouls if you were down on creatures in graveyard. Oath of Mages if you had less life. Oath of Druids if you had less creatures. Oath of Druids would be the standout card, ended up getting banned and restricted in different formats. Basically, if you're down on creatures, you get to go get a creature out of your library. Quite powerful. Oath of Ghouls, which lets you get stuff into your grave, was also a powerful card. Not quite as good as Oath of Druids. The worst was Oath of Mages. There's a big ongoing theme for a while that we make cycles, and red would have the worst one on the cycle, which Oath of Mages continued. The Keepers cost 2 colored mana of the respective color. They were 1/2 creatures with that color tap, and they allowed you to do something. Basically, like, blue cared about cards, so you could draw a card if you had less cards than your opponent, stuff like that. So the Oaths and the Keepers were new, you know, something new to the set. Back then, when we weren't adding new keywords, we would do things like add new cycles. That was a common thing we would do. So with the Oaths and the Keepers were added here. Probably, though, the thing that Exodus is most remembered for is there were a bunch of very powerful cards, a bunch of which got banned or restricted. So I'm going to walk through some of the very powerful cards that were in Exodus. Obviously, I already talked about Oath of Druids. That was 1 in a green. If you have an enchantment, if you have less creatures than your opponent, I think it's beginning of upkeep, then you're allowed to go get a creature out of your deck and put it, I believe, on the battlefield, I believe. It was very good. Okay, but that's not it. There were some more powerful cards. Survival of the Fittest. So Survival of the Fittest was 1 in a green in enchantment. You could spend a green mana, discard a creature from your hand to go to get a creature from your library and put it into your hand. So it allowed you to turn one creature into another creature. So you could tutor for creatures, which was very powerful. So interestingly, I'm going to talk about 4 cards here. So Survival of the Fittest, 3 of the 4 of them I made. I think Survival of the Fittest came from, I really was enamored. There was a card called Transmute Artifact that allowed you to take an artifact in play and then turn it into another artifact in your library, except you paid the difference in mana cost. I would fix that card in I'm not sure if fix is the right word. I would make it cleaner and way more broken and tinker. I would do that in Urza's Saga. But we'll get to that in Urza's Saga. But Survival of the Fittest was playing similar space. I really like engine cards. You can see here all my broken cards. A lot of them are engine cards. And what we mean by that is an engine card lets you turn one resource into another resource. So the idea, I could turn any card in my hand to any card in my library. Sorry, any creature in my hand, creature card, to any creature card in my library, which is very powerful. Next was Mind Over Matter, also one of my cards. 2 blue. So 6 mana total, 4 of which is blue. It's an enchantment. You can discard a card to tap or untap any permanent. That ended up being crazy good. Probably the most useful thing of it is it allows you to untap your land, meaning it allows you to turn cards in hand into mana. And then you can use that mana to get more cards into hand. And so it creates some fun loops. Obviously, it's 6 mana, 4 blue, so it was costed to be, but it turns out in the right deck, it's just so powerful that you still played it. So Mind Never Matter is, it just led you to do a lot of things. And on top of it, we also made a bunch of lands that tap for more than 1 mana. Obviously, there's a saga, we picked the most broken one, which is Tolarian Academy, that tapped for blue equals the number of artifacts you had. So the idea that you could tap, you could tap for lots of mana. In fact, enough mana to cast Mind Over Matter. And then discard a card to untap Tolarian Academy to get 6 more blue mana or whatever. Okay, next up, Limited Resources. the one I did make of these four. Limited resources was an enchantment for one white mana. And it said, each player chooses five lands. Oh, sorry. It's an enchantment. Each player, when it enters, each player chooses five lands and then has to sack all the rest of the lands. And then, if there's 10 or more lands on the battlefield, nobody can play lands. It's what we call a lockout card. We've stopped doing these mostly. The idea that we just stop you from playing mana. There's a real famous card called Land Equilibrium that would shut people out. Anyway, cards that don't let you play mana usually aren't great cards. This was one of those. It's just very powerful. It allows you essentially to shut down mana production. And if your deck is made to deal with it, like you have a lot of artifact sources, it can be really powerful. Okay, and the final of the broken cards. These are the four that I think all got restricted and or banned. There's some other cards that are very powerful that I'll get to as well. Recurring Nightmare. So in Legends was a card called Hell's Caretaker that I really, really, really liked. It was a creature that you could sack a creature you had to go reanimate a creature out of the graveyard. Kind of like Survival of the Fittest. It turns one creature on the battlefield into a creature. It trades a creature on the battlefield for a creature in your graveyard. But probably what you're draining is not so good a creature for a very good creature. This one was an enchantment, and to keep you from doing it once a turn, or to limit you, is it would bounce it when you used it. So it's two and a black, and then you had to sacrifice a creature, and then you would bounce this enchantment and reanimate a creature. The funny thing is bouncing the enchantment, which we meant to be a drawback to limit how often you could do it, ended up being very powerful, because if your opponent tried to get rid of it, and as long as you had a creature in play, you could sack a creature to bounce it to keep it from being destroyed. So it's very hard to get rid of. And its ability to constantly get creatures back, you know, to take your worst creature on the battlefield to get your best creature in your graveyard. There were a lot of shenanigans. And so Recurring Nightmare was, as maybe one day I will do a podcast on, here's the card I liked. Here's the fixed version I did that was way more powerful. There's an era of time where I did a lot of that. Okay, let's talk about some other cards that I made. Some of them I made. These are cards in Exodus. I made some of them, but I did not make all of them. Although the next one I did make. Coat of Arms, 5 mana for an artifact. Each creature gets +1/+1 for every other creature that shares a creature type with it. This is Tempest Block. It is not until Onslaught Block that I convinced the powers that be to really push Typhal as a theme. But I really, really liked it, and I recognize there were players that really liked it. So Coat of Arms was my love letter to the Typhal fans, saying, look, because the reality is we only put Typhal cards out so often. We do a lot more now than we used to. But we did them, but they were slow. They came out slowly. And we tended to do them for the most popular creature type. So let's say you wanted to play something that was a little less popular. It was hard to get a Lord or something that you could build a deck around. So I made Coat of Arms just for you. Coat of Arms was like, look, just play a lot of the same creature. Doesn't matter what it is. Just play a lot of the same creature and Coat of Arms will make them good. So it kind of was made as a sort of a lord for whatever creature type you wanted. Next, City of Traders. So City of Traders was a land. It tapped for 2 colorless mana, but you sacrificed if you played another land. In the early days, we dabbled a lot with lands that tapped for more than 1 mana. Obviously, Talarian Academy coming up in Talarian Academy and Sarah's Sanctum. And there's ones coming up in Urza Saga that are even more broken. But City of Traders still is over the line. We really have come to realize that tapping for more than 1 mana really is not ideal. Even with drawbacks. And this drawback's mostly like just played this last. It was a good land. Tapping for 2 mana is very good. Next up. Okay, back to cards I made. Hatred. So Hatred is 3 black. It's an instant. Pay X life, and then your creature gets +X/+0 to end of turn. So the idea of this card, the reason it was so good, and this might have been banned restricted somewhere. My memory is it was. I didn't have it in my list of things that got banned restricted, but I think it was. So Hatred allowed you to turn a resource, your life, into creature power, but it was a resource that could end games. And one of the powerful things from this block was shadow creatures. Shadow creatures were unblockable. So shadow, I didn't explain shadow. So buyback was the mechanic where you could pay extra mana and the card stayed in your hand rather than go to the discard pile. Shadow was an evasion ability that said, creatures with shadow can only be blocked by creatures with shadow. Kind of like flying, except flying can block non-flyers. Shadow can only block shadow, can't block non-shadow. But if I had an aggressive deck, and shadow creatures were on the aggressive side, if I had an aggressive deck with shadow, it was hard for you. All I needed to do to win with hatred is have more life than you. And so, now given I had to get to 5 mana to cast the hatred, but if I'm playing a shadow deck where I'm just being more aggressive than you, I tend to be ahead of you. And if you're not playing shadow, I have a creature you can't block. And so shadow plus hatred is very powerful. Not the only powerful thing. I think there was also a zombie deck that used hatred. Zombies, there was another very aggressive. I put Sarcomancy in Tempest, and that also led. There's a very powerful zombie deck. Anyway, I made some powerful cards. Next up, Null Brooch. So Null Brooch was an artifact that costs 4. For 3 and tap, you discard your hand to counter a non-creature spell. So there's a bunch of things going on. First and foremost, one of the things we decided, early Magic, we messed around with lots of colorless artifacts for all sorts of effects. We later realized that we really didn't want counterspells being in every deck. Given this is a restrictive counterspell, and obviously you have to discard your hand, so it's not a particularly great counterspell, but we kind of decided we just didn't want counterspells. Like, really, counterspells are mostly in blue. We did a little bit in white and red, do a little bit of redirecting and stuff, but we want to be careful. Counterspells are a very polarizing thing. We do think there's players that enjoy them. We do think it can be fun, but we want to make sure that they're not in too many decks, and that there's a lot of people that really dislike counterspells, so we want to sort of keep them in their lane, if you will. Now, the interesting story about Null Brooch is originally it was not Null Brooch, it was Jeweled Brooch. The reason that's important is, people might remember, there is a card in Tempest called Jeweled Idol, and there's a card in Stronghold called Jeweled Ring. Originally, my plan was, so each Jeweled Idol and Jeweled Ring, you can do things to give them to your opponent, and then there's some ramifications of it. The way this worked originally was I made 3 cards, what we call Mega Cycle. I put 1 in each set, and the idea was if I get all 3 in play at one time, I can give them to my opponent, and if all 3 are together, the way it would trigger is it basically would win me the game. So I had to get, the idea is get all Jinx items in play, get all Jinx items to your opponent, and if you manage to do that, then you will win the game. R&D decided last minute they didn't want to do that, and even though we made the first 2, they changed this. So this card was supposed to be a different card, and it got changed. So the thing that's most interesting to me is that stop me at the second one. Like, if you're going to make, I don't know, it's odd. Like, if I'm going to make 3 and you're not going to do all 3, well, just let me make 1 or 0. But don't let me make 2. Now, given the way the 2 were made, it's not clear that they were a combo. I don't know if people realized they were missing a third piece. Like, a lot of people realized that I built it so it was a win condition if you got all 3 together. So, that's no bridge. Spiked Cannibal. So Spiked Cannibal was the only black spike. So remember, spikes, I originally made spike during Tempest Design. We ended up pushing them back to Stronghold, except we left 1 spike, the 1 mana spike. We left 1 spike as a teaser in Tempest. Then the rest of the spikes showed up here, and then we made some more spikes in Exodus. I think Spike Feeder, I think it was in Exodus. Spike Feeder, so all the spikes, what they do is they enter with some number of +1/+1 counters. Then for 2 mana, you can move the +1/+1 counters to another creature. The nice thing about the spikes is all the spikes have the ability to move them, so that if you move them to another spike, you still could move them around. So spikes could sort of move them around amongst themselves. But you were allowed to move them to any creature, just they got unlocked when you moved them to a non-spike. And then there were means, like Spike Feeder, where you also could trade in the counters for some resource. Spike Feeder traded in for life. 4 life, if I remember correctly. So the idea is that I can make creatures bigger, and I can get other resources. I can make tokens, and anyway, you could do different things to the spikes. The Spike Cannibal, what it did, it was, I think, a single black, no, 1 black. It was a 0/0 that entered with 1+1/+1 counter, plus it stole all the counters from all the other spikes. So the idea was, it wasn't something to be played with spikes, it was something to be played against spikes. It was kind of a sideboard card for spikes. So if your let's say you were playing your friend and they had a spike deck, you could play a spike cannibal and eat all their plus one counters. I'm not quite sure why we, back in the day, we would sometimes kind of host themes within the set, and we've been a little bit better about that. We like to have answers. Obviously, we want you to have answers for themes, but this one is a little mean. It's also the only black spike. I'm almost at work here. Exodus, there was a lot of very powerful cards in Exodus. That is a lot of the memory of it. One more card. I'll tell a little story. A minute before I'm at the office. There's a card in Exodus called Forbid. So Forbid is a counter spell, but you can discard two cards to buy it back. So the idea is that it's a counter spell that you can buy back. Now, you got to discard two cards, so it's not something you can buy back infinitely, but you can buy back a little bit. So when Exodus came out, we were doing something called the Junior Super Series. And that was people under the 18 could play in a tournament. And then if they won, they would win scholarship money. And we held the event usually down in Florida. We flew in the PT winners of that year to be special guests for the Junior Super Series kids. So John Finkel had won in New York, I think, his first Pro Tour. And so I was really interested because John was a control player. So I showed him Forbid, and I said, what do you think of this? And his first impression was, he goes, oh, yeah, I don't think it's very good. And I said, John, I think it's better than you think it is. And then later that year, I was at Nationals, and John Finkel comes up to me on the first day, and he says, okay, you were right. It's way better than I thought it was. And that's the Nationals that he played Forbidian, which was Ophidian and Forbid. So it was a control deck, but Forbid was a major big player in it. So I always thought that was funny. But anyway, guys, Exodus ended up doing well. In general, the Tempest block did quite well. As you remember from me explaining, I had been hired as a developer. I really wanted to be a designer. Tempest Block was my first chance to be a designer. It went really well, so much so that I actually moved from being a developer to becoming a designer. And starting from Tempest forward, I was on most of the design sets for a while. I didn't lead all of them, but I led some of them. And I was on Exodus, I was on Stronghold, I led Tempest. Tempest Block was my transition from being a developer to becoming a designer, which was the first on my step to becoming head designer. So I have a very fondness for Tempest Block. Exodus will always have a little bit of a stain on it for me, just because of the drama with Michael and I. I'm very proud of our work on the Weatherlight Saga. I wish we could have told the story that Michael and I wrote. Not that the story that got made. There's lots of cool parts of the story that got made, but I will always have a soft spot for our original story, which, by the way, if you want to hear, I did a podcast where I went through and I talked about our original stories. If you really want to hear that, I did make a podcast for that already. But anyway, guys, I am here at work. So I hope you enjoyed my jaunt through Exodus. A lot of cool stuff in it. It was a fun set. Definitely, it was a long time ago. But I'm very proud of Exodus mechanically. Story could have been a little different, but I'm very proud of the mechanic. There's a lot of cool stuff in it, a lot of cool cards, a lot of cool designs, and I probably made a few broken things, but at least they're memorable cards. I made a lot of memorable cards, I'll say that. But anyway, guys, now that I'm at work, we all know that means instead of talking magic, it's time for me to make magic. So hope you enjoyed my journey through Exodus today, but it's time for my Exodus to go to work. So with that, I'll talk to you guys next time. Bye-bye.